Petition number 11206, Reel 15.
Mr. T. Thornthwaite, Reel 15. On what day did you return to Brandsmouth after your leave from coming abroad, Mr. Thornthwaite?
Well, after the 28 days' leave, returned to Brandsmouth on the 5th of November, 43. We went billeted in a hut there, along, not with the recruits, but near all the young recruits there. We went, the manager of the cinema in Durham City laid on a film show for us, and we went there and we sat upstairs on the balcony, and the manager introduced us to the audience, saying that these were the 12 people, that are the first people from the Durhams to come home on service abroad. Because at this time, when all this was happening, the 1st Battalion had landed in Kos, and there was only a few survivors that got out of it, some, you know, prisoner of war and that. So the actual 1st Battalion was no longer in being when we were in Durham on this show. But after the show, we went to the inside the cinema, and they laid on a meal for us. This was all paid for by the staff and everything of the cinema. And then they had a dance. But the dance was a bit of a washout, unfortunately, because we were all dead sober, and we needed Dutch courage to get up and dance with the young girls, and they were all wanting to entertain us on the floor. So we were all very shy, and it was a very nice evening, and enjoyed it, because I went knocked around with one of the girls for a couple of months after that. She lived in Durham City itself. So when we returned back to the barracks again, as I say, and we were an embarrassment to the whole setup at the Brandsmouth training camp, because they're all young recruits of 300 to 400 young kids, all very keen, and all. We then had the African Star ribbon being issued, and we had it up. And all want to know what it was like and everything. The instructors had managed to, since Dunkirk, most of them, they'd come back to Brandsmouth, and they'd never been away abroad since. And of course, they wanted us out the road because we're an embarrassment to them as well. Well, as I say, we're an embarrassment to them for the simple reason they were teaching the recruits, training them for action. And we were talking to them in the dining rooms and places in the canteen and things like that, talking them different. There was no aggro, but they just wanted us out of the camp. So even when we went in the dining rooms, we had a queue up to go in, and the ATS girls were serving the meals. And when you got to them and you had the African Star up, oh, they said, here's one of, you know, they were really putting it on, our heroes, and they used to give you a double of everything and pile your plate up. And I remember one little instance, there was a chap in front of me, and you got a plate with soup on and one with your meal on, and they put a piece of slice of bread on the side of the soup plate, and then he went away and sat down. Well, unfortunately, this poor chap in front, the bread fell off. He put the plate down and he bent down to pick it up, and he had a toupee. He was bald as a badger. I don't know what happened, something, and it fell in his soup. And he took it out and he shook it and he put it on, and it was one side, and it was very embarrassing for him. But we used to get fed very well, because the young lads, they were, you know, with the activities and training, they used to get a pie, a half a pie, at 11 o'clock break with a pot of cocoa or something. And of course, we always got a whole pie, and they complained about it. And this thing. But to find something for us to do, they started taking us out on route marches. We had a sergeant there. He was a keep fit character, and he more or less said, "I'll work them. I'll work them off their feet, no mind they be in the Western Desert or not." This sort of feeling. We go out to camp and march up the country lanes of Durham, and he'd keep on saying, "Come on, keep up, keep up." And when we got near the camp, we started. We used to put the pressure on. We're standing on his heels, and then eventually we used to pass him. And he was at the back of the squad, and we come into camp, and he was behind, and he used to get highly annoyed about it. But we were full of devilment, because they didn't know what to do with us. One thing we met, which we never met in the desert, was a paint gun. I don't even know the paint gun. So they said, "Well, we'll teach you how to use it." So they had two poles about 6 foot apart, about 6 foot high, and a rope across, and they tied a petrol drum in the centre. And the idea was you had to aim this paint gun, which was a dummy shell in it. You aim it and hit the petrol drum, which is supposed to be a tank or something like that. Of course, what we did, we used to aim at one of the posts and knock the post down. And he used to get highly annoyed, and he says, "You're supposed to aim at the tin. Can't you see the tin?" And he put it all up, and then we knocked the other post down. And they gave up on that one as a hopeless hopeless effort.
What did the paint gun look like?
It was like a piece of drain, the downcome of a drain pipe. Something like that, with a stock on the handle on the end. And it had a big spring, and you had to stand it on its butt and push the spring down. And then you put the bomb, which is a bomb about the size 9 inches long, had a tail on the end, and you put it in. And what happened is when you press the trigger, the thing flew out because it was only a short distance, 20 feet at the most. The idea, you're supposed to get into hedges normally, which when we used them, you get into a hedge to fire at a tank, but it was no good after that, just a short distance. One of the disadvantages was that it used to get full of dirt and mud, and when you pressed the trigger, the thing didn't, it just fell out. But
did it have much of a kick when you...
No. It was just a heavy spring, that was all, and I mean, it just slung the thing out 20 feet. It had no explosive chance to send it out. And you had a carrier with four bombs in, you carry them in a holder. So as I said, they mucked about with that, route marches. And then there was a major, an ex-farmer. He was a farmer in Durham. He came into the Doan. I think he was on the terrier mine. He must have been a terrier, but he came in as a major. And they made him sports officer at Bransworth Camp. And he got us lot to start making a hockey pitch. We had wheelbarrows and shoveling gravel and stuff and working on making this gravel pitch. If we did a certain lot in a certain time, he said, "Give us a weekend pass." So a form of bribery. So the kept it as that.
What was his name? Do you recall his
name? No, I can't remember him because I never knew him in the Durhams. And I just met him for the short period in Bransford. Entertainment at night time used to go up to a little village higher up from towards Crook. I'm forgetting the name of it.
Willington.
We used to go to Willington at night for a drink there. Because I started knocking around with an ATS girl there. She was a cook in the Sergeant's Mess. She came from Hull, but she was a very good singer. And I used to go to this pub in Willington, and she'd get up and sing, because it was all full of troops. There was a few local people in, but mostly troops. And, of course, the beer came over, and I never used to buy any beer. And even when there was that much beer, the women used to bring cakes in when she was singing. They were in tears, some of the little ladies there were listening. And I was on a good thing there as far as beer and cakes were. Well, this went on for a period of time, and then eventually we were told we were going to, 10 of us, not 12, it's 10 of us, we had to pack our kit, and we're going down to a place called Winfleet, near the Wash, Lowestoft. So we, next morning we got on the train and we went down to Winfleet, eventually landed there, and it was a small village in the country area. And I always remember the land over near the Wash was all flat land, and all they used to do was give us cross-country runs.
Who did you join down there?
Well, we joined this draft of young lads, all young kids. we joined this crowd in. We were billeted in warehouses of some kind down there. And one morning, we had to go to the cinema down the road for a medical inspection. So we went into the cinema, were told to take my shirts off and queue up in the, where the foyer was to go onto the stage. And on the stage was the medical officer, and he was giving you a medical check. Now, I was standing there, and I noticed two of my friends standing to one side on the stage, because you went up, seen the doctor, and then they disappeared. But these three were standing there. So when I got up, and the medical officer says to me, "Where have you come from?" I says, "Brantford." He says, before that, where did you come? I says, "The Middle East." He says, "Stand over there." And eventually, there was 10 of us standing together, and all these young kids had gone, but we stood out like a sore thumb. We were brown and they were lily white. So he says, "Well, this draft is going to Burma." He says, "You lot, 10, are going back to Brantford tomorrow morning again." And we're packing the kit and away back to Brantford again. And then this order came out from the War Office, from the government, to the effect that people like us who had come home on service abroad couldn't be sent out of England for 6 months. You had to be in England 6 months before you could be posted abroad again. Because I remember later on we joined the 50th Day, 68th and 9th Battalion, and we're planning for D-Day. And D-Day was a week before our 6 months was up. And the CO of the 8th Battalion, where I was with at the time, sent for us and said that we know you shouldn't be going, but he says, as soon as we get there, as soon as we get sorted out, he says, I'll have you send back the first opportunity. But he says, you're not going back now because you can't. So, as I said, we went back to Brantford.
Do you recall what time this was, what date this was, that you went down to Lowestoft and came back?
Well, I said next morning we'll come back. It wasn't actually next morning because it was about, I think we were there about 2 or 3 weeks. Because as I said, we'd done a lot of cross-country running. That's all we seemed to do. Because another sergeant come to me and he stopped me on one of these runs and he says, "Would you like a Lance Corporal? Do you want a stripe?" I says, "No." Of course, we didn't know then that there was a draft going to Burma. We didn't know where it was going. So we're there about a fortnight, I think, and then we come back to Brantford. And, of course, the same thing happened again at Brantford. So they just used to give us odd jobs to do to keep us out of the way.
Was there any men at Brantford, particularly amongst the older ones, who were a bit envious of the fact that you'd been in action and kind of...
Do you mean the instructors?
Were unpleasant about it in any way?
Not really. There was some that were cynical because, unfortunately, it's a thing. You can't help it. You know, when they're trying to teach something, and we say, well, in action you don't do it. Another thing he was saying, when we trained at Brantford, keep your behinds down. And we were saying, don't worry, well, we're in action, we'll keep it down. But he said, it's uncomfortable keeping it down, we're just training. And of course, everything they were trying to teach us, we were upsetting it by giving the practical side of it, how it reversed. Some of them were all right, but they just wanted us out the light, out the road, you know.
Did you feel that the training that you were getting in the light of your own experience wasn't the kind of thing that you knew these new recruits needed for action?
No, I mean, the stuff that they were teaching us, other than the paid gun, was useless. I mean, they were teaching you how to go on an action. Well, I mean, there was no point, actually. You'd already been in action a few times. I mean... You're self-taught, and you knew more than they did, how they're teaching, how it was going to work out. when he actually put it into practice. But providing we kept out of the way, they seemed to be all right. So we mucked about there. And then, when was it? I can't remember the date when we left there, and we went and joined the 50th David. I say they were down south on the coast. There were 8th Battalion, I think. Yes, 8th Battalion was the one I was in. There seems to be a gap somewhere here. Oh yes, I remember. They gave me a job before we went down there. They gave me a job of looking after the boilers for each company had its own hot water system. That was my job, and I was just left alone to do that. It was very handy. And then from there, I went over as handyman for the sergeant's mess. And that was a good job because I just went out the back and I hadn't to go out the camp gates. I just went out the back and coming in, went out when I want to and came in. Because in the mornings, I used to go out the back of the camp and go down to Page Bank looking for mushrooms. And I remember I didn't know what a mushroom was, the difference between them. And I collected a lot in a hanky one day, and I was coming back and I seen an old pitman coming back. And I says, could you tell me which is mushrooms? And he says, put it down, open it, and he threw everything to one side with about three. When I got back, I was telling the people, I says, I bet he, when he got around the corner, he went and picked them all up. We used to go to Page Bank, a little dance hall down there. And then eventually, as I said, we left there and went down and joined the 50th Dave. I can't remember the Southwold. No. Southwold's near Blackpool, isn't it? No, Southwold, that was it, Southwold I think we went to. We were down that area. As I say, we're on the coastline, and all these individual villas up on the cliffs were all taken over by the government, and we were just occupying all these villas, and that was in there. There was a village there, completely all forces, they'd cleared all the civilians out, and it was a coastal town. And it was total army everywhere you went. From there, we started doing training for D-Day. Because I remember they took us out in a landing craft. And we sailed up the channel. And we could see the French coast when we were going up on these landing craft. And the Royal Marines were in charge of the landing craft. It went so far up, we didn't get fired on from the French coast, and then we turned and we landed at this place. We did a mock landing of the D-Day invasion on the beaches. Now this place has been in the papers a few times since about 300 North Americans who were drowned there. That was the same place where we landed.
How did you find the 8th Battalion? You were a regular soldier, many years service, and what was the battalion like?
Well, it was a funny experience altogether, because from being from a regular battalion to going to Terry Battalion, it was a case of like the Australian, very similar to the Australians. If they liked doing it, they'd do it when they were told to do a thing, and they would argue, and they'd call the sergeants by their first names, and all this sort of thing. It was unusual for our. But we got on all right with the people. I mean, obviously, we hadn't to start coming the old soldier by saying I was a regular and all this, because they get their backs up straight away. But we more or less stuck together. There was four of us, I think, in the company that I was in there.
Which company were you in?
I can't remember now. I couldn't remember the company. I seemed to lose, once I'd left my own battalion, I seemed to be just like a traveller with them. I had no interest at all in the regiment. That was being honest, because, I mean, they were all strange. The Terrier Battalion. So I just sort of ambled on with the rest and took very little interest. And as I say, this landing we did on the course, a mock landing, the Marines took us in, and we had a form of wader with the sealed bottoms. You pulled them on and tied them around your waist, and then you had your equipment on top. The idea being that you got off the landing craft and you waded onto the beach, and then when you go on the beach, you're supposed to rip these things off, and of course your boots and everything were dry. But what actually happened was there was quite a lot drowned when they left the landing craft. When the waves came up, it lifted you off the bottom, and your legs was full of air, and you had equipment on with bandoliers of ammunition and everything, and you immediately turned upside down, and quite a lot were drowned, so they changed that. After that, no equipment had to be fastened, everything had to be just hung on, so and eventually this happened, you just pulled the whole lot off and wiped yourself up. Montgomery was there at the time, and the jeep, and he went raving mad. There was tanks, ambulances, all mixed up, right shambles it was. It was terrible. But everything was as it would they anticipated to be on D-Day. Because I was with a group, and we're walking along, and a chap stopped me, and he tied a label on me, and he says, right, go and sit down by the side of the roadway. He says, you're finished, you're out of action. Stopped there, medical people came along, put me on a stretcher, took me away to a first aid place. They gave me a pot of tea. From there, I was taken to the RAMC. The RAMC took me and put me on a train and took me to over 20 miles away to another place, took me and put me in hospital, and I went through all this procedure. Some of them even went by air. You know, they took to see how it all worked out. And we completed this training. And then it was a case of route marches and things like that. And we kept on moving further south down the coast. Eventually, we landed up at Romsey, outside Southampton. That was Lord Manbutton's estate place. We went in there. And we're in the woods, and I think there was 25,000 troops in them woods, and we all had bell tents, not bell tents, marquee things to sleep in, six burden per tent. We had no bed, and we just lay on the bottom amongst the leaves, and you couldn't find your kit, it was getting them. And the Americans were a guard round us, 25,000 troops in the woods. The Americans had a guard right round the perimeter. And outside that was the artillery. About half a mile was another big circle of guard. And outside that was the security police. Once we went into there, they were in a sealed camp. Because we'd done all the training, we'd seen all the maps and everything, where we're going to land. We'd seen aerial photographs of the beaches we're going to land on and everything. So nobody could leave there to get out. But one chap did get out. And he was picked up on King's Cross Station because we'd even been given 200 francs each. Everybody had 200 francs for when he got there.
This must have been near to D-Day.
Yes, it was getting near to D-Day.
Were the guards that you were talking about, they were there to keep you in?
To make sure you didn't nobody got out. Because we were always taking the mickey out of the Americans. They said, you come all the way from America to guard us to make sure we don't get away from Jones and... The poor Americans, I used to feel sorry for them. They said, I'll give my right arm to join you people. He says, I didn't join to come and guard you. And the Americans did all the administration. They'd done the feeding. Well, from what we were used to, it was like going into Blooming Dorchester Hotel. They had these big marquees, and you went in, and they had tables with tablecloths on. I mean, we'd never seen tablecloths in our life. They had that all laid out. And they had jugs of milk on the table and bowls of sugar. So you got your porridge and your pump. Of course, the first bloke comes along, he picks the jug up and drinks half the milk from the jug. Another one was putting the sugar in the pocket. And then the next meal, you queued up, and these Americans were standing with the big Dixies and everything and all the different... And the idea, the American had his big chef's hat on. They're all standing there, and he came along with your plate, and he kept on putting it on until such times you said that was enough. And I mean, Durhams are not big blokes to start with. And you see in their plates, they could hardly see over the top of them. And the American was looking at them to see he'd keep on piling more stuff on.
What kind of food was it? What kind of food were you getting?
Oh, it was lovely, beautiful. You know, beef, roast beef and stuff we never had. And all this sort of stuff. Of course, through everybody being so greedy, the food finished and there was about a half the battalion still at the field and they were going in riot. And then when he'd finished the meal, they had stoves, hot water, and had labels, big things, notice for wash, rinse, sterile your plate or your mess tin. The first thing they did, they went down with the bowl and took the water out to the tent for washing and shaving. That upset that system. And then they had a big naffy tent there, great big naffy tent, man. And a big notice that says all the girls here are from Durham area in the north of England, you know, to make you feel at home. But out of 25,000 troops there was about 600 or 700 Americans. And every American had one of the naffy girls, and we had to look and watch on. And what developed eventually was we had Baker-like grenades, what the SAS called stun grenades now. And you're supposed to use them when close in attack just for frightening them and things like that, stunning them. And our lads was hearing Americans in these tents with the naffy girls and were throwing these women Baker-like grenades in the tents. And eventually somebody threw a 36 hand grenade in, you know, and there was a lot of people wounded. And then it was clamped down and stop all this carry on. But it was just a case of jealousy. And a lot of blokes thought, well, if I do something and I get put in the guard room, I won't go on D-Day. So what they're doing, they were fighting and hitting NCOs, and the CO had us all together. And he says, the trend is that there's a lot of you people getting into more trouble than they've ever been. And he says, and you're not pulling any wool over my eyes. He says, but I'll tell you, there's none of you going to stop here. He says, no matter what you do, you're all going over with us. He says, and I'll deal with you at a later date. So that stopped that. They said, well, there's not much point. So, yeah.
Did you find, as the days got closer to D-Day, that there was any desertions? Were there many people leaving?
You couldn't get out.
Couldn't get out.
Oh, no. Well, that's it. I mean, there's only one chap did get out, and he was picked up at the station, a chap called Senior.
But how many of your battalion had already served in Egypt and the desert?
Well, the 50th day was brought home, you know, from Italy.
But there would be quite a number in your battalion who were veterans in their
own
right.
Oh, yes. There was quite a lot of the terriers had been in the desert and all the rest of it. You know, the old hands. Of course, there was a lot of recruits that made the strength up. And another thing, we didn't know what day D-Day was. We didn't know what day it was. And the latter part, the last week, there's nothing, all rations came in, there was nothing went out. Even there were dry shod toilets, and the ref, it was all burnt. It wasn't taken out by carton, and it was all burnt. Everything was burnt within the camp. And of course, there was a little village within this big woods, and there was a post box, and some people even added it, wrote and posted a letter there, thinking it wouldn't be censored, but obviously it was. They were all connected just the same. And we just went on lectures and showing maps and showing aerial photographs of where we're going to land and what we're involved and things like that. And
did you find these useful?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they were marvellous. I mean, they showed us actually the beach we'd land on, and they showed us the buildings we'd come up against. And it was dead right. They were spot on. Yeah. Oh, they were very good.
Were you a rifleman in one of the companies?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall your company commander or battalion commander?
Battalion commander, I think, was Wood, Colonel Wood, because he was captured the first night. But I'm not sure whether he got away or not. I'm not quite sure. One of the lieutenant in charge of our platoon came from Durham. I can't remember his name, but his father used to be a music hall comedian. He's well known as a comedian. This lieutenant is a canny bloke, you know. But as I say, we mucked around there until such times as we told to pack our kit, and we went down and got into trucks, went down to Southampton, went to the dock area, and I remember the dock area, they had it all prepared. There was, where the warehouses was, there was hundreds of taps for people to wash, you know, for all the troops that was going to come through. And we were led to a landing craft, LCT, landing craft troops. And we went on. There was about 40, I think. About 40 or 50 to each craft. And it was manned by Americans. The Americans were